succession number 27310, reel 2.
The Gabba, reel 2. How did you get to Canada?
I think it was a Queen Elizabeth troop ship. Can you hold this up a moment? We went on on the QE, which is a troop ship, thousands of people aboard. I had a single cabin in the Queen Elizabeth with 9 other men, 10 of us in one cabin. But they made bunks, and we went over there. I'm not sure how long it took. We landed in Moncton, Nova Scotia, and then by train to Kingston, Ontario.
What was Canada like after coming from England in the
cold? Snow everywhere. The lake was frozen. We were on Kingston's on the shores of Lake Ontario. It was frozen hard. So hard that it supported a coach when it fell on off the road onto it. That was it. It was cold, and but very pleasant. People were very, very good to us.
Was food more plentiful?
Yes, yes. Food was there was no problem with food. I remember when we first got on the Queen Elizabeth that the first meal was hard-boiled eggs. And I saw guys eating 10 of the bloody things. But, no, the food in Canada was plentiful, and the camp was very good.
So I take it you were there for advanced flying training?
Yeah.
Where did that take place?
At Kingston itself, and around about there. We did everything there. We were flying Harvards there.
What was the Harvard like after flying the Tiger Moth?
Well, it was like it was a chalk and cheese. It had all sorts of different characteristics. When you're flying a Tiger Moth, the loop is fairly simple. The roll was more difficult because it had less power and you had to be careful. With the Harvard, the opposite was the case. Rolls were comparatively simple. Loops were something you had to be very careful to be able to do.
What was the technique with a loop with a Harvard then?
Well, I very nearly got busted for it. You had to dive and pull it up and then get over the top there. And I repeatedly failed just before you get to the top and you have to, and the thing falls away and you have to make sure you don't spin. And on one famous occasion, my instructor got fairly exasperated with me, and we were out at another field, and he said to me, "I'm going into the mess there, and I'm going to look out of the window, and you go take this thing up and do a loop, and if you fall out of the loop, you're busted." So I went and managed to make it do it, but I found the loop difficult in the harbour.
When people were training to fly, did they find different elements of it difficult? Would one, as you say, you found the loop hard, but would
the loop in the
harbour?
Yeah, if you were ham-fisted, you couldn't make it. I mean, if you couldn't learn to fly a course at a set altitude and speed, you'll find it difficult. It's each aspect of flying is in itself an art.
And what would happen to a trainee if they were busted? What would they?
They'd go back. I'm not sure. The pilot trainees may have been off to go out as navigators, observers, or else they would, having joined the Navy, they'd be reduced to the ranks and go back into ordinary seamen.
Obviously, you're doing rolls and that sort of thing. Did the Harvard, as I say, differ from the Tiger Moth in the types of things that you would do with it?
Well, yes, it was. You know, it became it was the step onto monoplanes, powerful monoplanes. The Harvard, by all accounts, is not powerful, but nevertheless, compared to the Tiger Moth, it was like moving into a Spitfire. But No, the techniques were different. You had to be very careful. For instance, you had the Tiger Moth. You didn't have a variable pitch propeller. With a Harvard, you did, and therefore, if you did it, if you had the pitch at the wrong setting, it wasn't good for what you were trying to do.
What about flying conditions in Canada?
Excellent. Generally blue skies, I seem to remember. We did have a period of... I don't know what they call it. It's when it gets very cold after rain, and you get a peculiar kind of ice forming. You have to be very careful with that.
It's like an ice storm, isn't it?
No, it's the thing that I remember was the trees got laden with icicles. They were, I think, it was something called super cool droplets or something like that. Where they come down from on high, and they'd be frozen on the way down, sort of thing. My memory is vague; it's many years ago now, but I seem to remember that that was a problem. But otherwise, we were—I don't think we had the big pea supers or anything like that. It was generally either it was snowing or it was sun was shining.
What about navigation in Canada? Because I'm assuming it was relatively
Navigation flat. Was part of the exercise of learning how to do. You had to learn to map read. You also had to learn to fly by instruments. Part of the training of being a pilot was to fly at a set speed and altitude and direction, and that was all part of the training. We did also low-level cross-countries and also distance cross-countries where you fly triangular course, both dual pilot and both solo. You also did a lot of instrument flying under, pull the hood over so you couldn't see outside, and you flew with an instructor to a set course and speed. That was part of the navigation exercise.
With instrument flying, is there any things that you need to remember?
Look at your instruments. You had no scope for variation. If you had to fly at 120 knots, you flew at 120 knots. If you had to fly 10 degrees west, you flew 10 degrees west. That was the instruction. There was no you couldn't do it haphazardly.
But you had to trust your instruments.
You had to trust your instruments. Not that I ever could, but you had to.
Is that an easy thing to do, though, trust purely your instruments?
Depends on your mentality. I can't say that I ever became totally confident flying by instruments.
Could anything upset the instruments that you were flying by?
Well, they're machines, and they could be, for instance, you could have the wrong setting for due north. You could have set the thing wrongly. You have a magnetic compass, but you also got a direction finder in the instrument panel, direction, and that in itself is a problem.
When you'd done most of your training in Canada, did you pass out there?
Yes. It was at Canada we were given our wings, flying badge.
It might seem a silly question, but how did you feel about that?
Elated. Elated. Two or three were finally failed, but by and large it was big, yeah. Especially when most of us were passed out as either midshipmen or acting sub-lieutenant.
What did you pass out as?
Acting sub-lieutenant.
And with that, how competent do you feel as a pilot having gone through this whole process?
You feel you know everything. But as a lecturer told me sometime later, that when you've flown 200, by that time we had flown 180 hours. He said, when you fly, you get to something like 250, you think you know it all. But when you get to 500 hours, you realise how little you know at 250.
What was the next move?
Next move, back to London, get your uniform, and we reported up to, I'm not sure, I think it was East Haven, certainly in Scotland, where we familiarised ourselves on swordfish.
Can you tell me about the swordfish? Because it's a very famous aircraft, isn't it?
It was an aircraft that was, in my opinion, utterly docile. If you behave yourself, he never bit you. Slow, safe. We learnt to carry torpedoes with it and drop torpedoes with it. Open cockpit. I enjoyed my time in Swordfish.
Because obviously, until that point, although you've been with an instructor and soloing, you wouldn't have carried any crew, would you, with a Swordfish?
No. But we never carried a crew while we're training at all. There was no more, and equally, you were solo. I don't believe, in fact, I'm not sure, but I don't believe there were any dual control Swordfish. You were told, you were given the instructions, you had the flying notes, you had lectures beforehand, and then you took off. By that time, you think you know everything, so it didn't particularly worry.
You did mention that you did training with torpedoes.
Yeah, that was done further on at the next place, RNAS Crail.
What does that involve, actually dropping a torpedo? What's the technique for dropping a torpedo, what you need to know as a pilot?
You need to be at the right height. You obviously want to be in the right direction. And your wings and nose be straight. You have... in your logbook, there was a piece added on which plotted every torpedo drop you made in training, because there was a camera which fired at the time you dropped the torpedo, and that registered everything, your height above sea level, your whether the wings were up or down, whether the nose were up or down, the distance from the target, all of which was important in the technique, and that was plotted, and you saw this on a graph, and you kept it on a graph, and they knew what you were doing as well.
And where would you practice? Would there be a designated area?
In the first and fourth. In the first and fourth, yes.
What would the target be for you to be aiming at?
I can't remember. You were... yes, if you were doing a runner, in other words, if you dropped the torpedo with... we just dropped the torpedo, it wasn't a runner. You would be aiming at a ship, and it would drop, and the camera would photograph what you've done, and that would be the assessment of how successful you were.
Did you take to that easily?
I enjoyed that immensely, yes. I enjoyed because the technique we were shown was that you would fly, get up to something like... Coming. Well, the thing that we did, they'd get up to 5,000 feet. I seem to remember 5,000 feet. And we would be in extended line astern. We'd be three aircraft, and we'd be a couple of thousand feet between us. And then we'd dive. And that was exhilarating, because the diving in an open cockpit... We dived down, and finally I think we flattened out at 500 feet and then turned and got down to 200 feet, which was the dropping height. And that I found exhilarating. Loved it.
Obviously you'd be aiming at a moving target.
Yeah.
How do you calculate that while you're flying, the speed and the way that target's moving?
Well... If I said by guess and by God, it would be probably nearer the truth. But you were supposed to assess the speed of the target by the weight. And in a swordfish, you had a very elementary sight, which was a bar across the front of the cockpit with knobs on. And you were, if you estimated it was so much, you aimed off 1 knot or 2 knots, that sort of thing. Whether one ever did it in practice, God alone knows. It seems to me that when they want to drop their torpedoes, they headed for the boat and let fly. But
so there's an element of skill and judgment in it. Isn't
there? Was an element of judgment in it, but whether it was successful, I had no opportunity of ever finding out.
So while you were at Crail, did you do any other work other than the torpedo dropping?
Formation flying, night flying, night navigation.
I imagine with the Crail obviously being in Scotland, it was a little bit more difficult to do night navigation up there than it was, say, in Canada.
No, I think you did it. You flew courses and times. You had to plot your flight. So therefore you would know that you would do this, that and the other, and then there were various beacons that you should have known were, so you came back to your base on that basis.
Would the weather affect the
weather
flights?
Weather was a dominant factor, but as trainees they didn't put you up in bad weather. Even for instance, I remember there would be a morning inspection by one of the instructors flying over the Moray Firth area, and he would give an opinion on the height of the sea. For instance, if the sea was absolutely flat calm, that's very dangerous because you wouldn't be able to assess too well your height above sea level. So you would be warned that such and such was the case.
So you would be prepared prior to that, any kind of...
You'd be told.
Would that be the briefing?
The briefing would be that seas are choppy, there's a 3-foot swell or something after that nature. Whether it was true or not, we wouldn't know. The other thing, of course, that we learnt at Crail was formation flying and the thing they called ADLs, Aerodrome Dummy Dick Landing. They would all be part of the training at Crail or at the subsidiary field.
Tell me about the ADLs, how you did those.
Well, that was the famous pictures of aircraft on a World War II carrier was where all the aircraft were lined up in there, and then you take off. And with the Fleet Air Arm pilots, we had a very tight circuit. The RAF would, well, certain bombers would be a hell of a thing. We did a big circle round, and part of our training was a thing called circuits and bumps, where you would you'd get a few planes, a half dozen planes, they'd take off at intervals and fly around the tight circuit, touch down and take off again, and that was all part of the technique of coming in. We were also taught the rudiments of the batsman, obeying batsman's instructions to land. That was all part of Crail training.
And I believe the Fleet Air Arm lands slightly differently from the RAF as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, they land with a very short circuit. You come in, the RAF fly straight onto the ground. With Fleet Air Arm, certainly with all the aircraft I flew, you would come in very tight round, so that you had the carrier, you see, the ethics of the carrier was that it remained on a level course for as little as possible. So if they wanted to fly the planes off and on, they had to move it, you had to move it.
Would you do a three-point landing, though, as well?
Yes, you'd have to drop it onto the target. You don't run it on two wheels, you drop it onto the target.
So what else happened at Crail while you were there?
Well, that was the end of my operational training. I went from there to I was in a station nearby, I forget, where they actually carried on night flying to a very great extent. And it was there that I had my first accident, whereby I, after a series of bad weather, we were brought onto the runway by people with their sticks, and I was brought on, and I saw a green light, and I took off, but the guy in front of me, who was the green light was really for, hadn't taken off. Well, he'd taken off, he got about 10 feet up, and I chopped right up his tail, and we both landed and walked away from it, but that was sufficient to take me out of the operational training.
How did it take you out? Was it through injury or...?
No. No, we were both uninjured, but there was a disciplinary court, went up before the skipper, and I was... lost 3 months seniority and dismissed ship, and I went down to Worthy Down. But that's my argument there was I was railroaded into that, but it's too late now.
It seems quite harsh discipline for an accident that's occurred during training. Was Fleet Air Arm discipline quite harsh?
Well, you're now coming on to my personal opinion. I reckoned that I was made the subject of a disciplinary court because the organisation was at fault, and it was far easier to charge me than to explain how two aircraft came onto the runway at the same time. Two aircraft had been brought onto the runway at the same time. Now, that's my personal opinion, and although it was many years ago, I still hold it.
So it would be, obviously, whoever was organising that night's flying.
Yeah, well, there was a famous man, Lieutenant Commander, who obviously I won't name, who I reckon was the culprit there.
What happened when you went down to Worthy Down? What was there?
Worthy Down was an aerodrome, or a ship, that was training... wireless operators, and the pilots there took aircraft up and flew the wireless operators who were carrying out exercises. So all we would do was fly them out 100 miles and bring them back again and take them up for 2 hours, and they would meanwhile be in touch with their base, taking instruction, learning signalling and all the other things.
So with that, were you getting an awful lot of flying hours?
I did a lot of flying hours. There were one, two, three different types of aircraft there.
What were they that you...
There was a Proctor, which was the first one. And then I went on to Lysanders. And there was also another aircraft, an American aircraft called a Seamew, which I flew once or twice.
What was the Seamew like?
A monstrosity. It was it had a very peculiar undercarriage which was very springy, so that if you landed heavily you'd go and take off again. As I say, I only flew it a couple of times. It was just another aircraft, and I think they'd got it under lend lease, and That was in use. It was only in use, I believe, at Worthy Down. I'd never heard it used anywhere else in the Fleet Air Arm.
How did it handle in the air?
As I say, quite normal. We weren't doing anything spectacular. We were just taking off, flying out, and coming back again.
was it a slow aircraft, though?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was 130 knots or something like that.
And would that take yourself and the wireless operator?
It would have taken in active service a full crew, but the pilot and the navigator, the pilot and the wireless operator would be in there. Telegraph air gunner, that's what they're called.
And you flew the Lysander?
Flew the Lysander.
What was that like?
That was a marvellous plane. That was a plane that you could fly it at 40 or 50 knots. And it would stay in the air. I used to enjoy taking it up with my getting up to about 8,000 feet, something like that, and then making it go as slow as possible, and seeing the ground, because you would, and if you got into the right wind, you'd be going backwards according to the ground. And I always imagine farmers looking at aircraft going backwards, because it was that kind of aircraft. You could land it at something like 60 knots or something.
I believe it had quite a short landing capacity as well.
Yes, if you did it right. You see, at Worthy Down, apparently every landing path was uphill. It was Worthy Down was a grass field with a kind of a hog's back, And so you landed uphill, and I suffered with the Lysander in the same way as I suffered with the albacore, because it had, both of them had noses which head down. And so when you tried to do a stick landing, I'd always pull the tail nose up too far. So I managed to, on one occasion, I think I wrote off the tailwheel on the Lysander during this idiocy.
You mentioned to me off the tape about the character of Worthy Down itself, that it had been camouflaged.
Yes, well, Worthy Down had been a First World War aerodrome. In fact, my batman, batman to eight of us there, he had been there when Air Marshal Tedder was a pilot officer or something like that. Well, anyway, it was a First World War place which was totally grass, and it had been camouflaged to show it was a road with a road running across it and various other things, and they spent a lot of money camouflaging it. And then they put a bloody great sign into the grass that I could read at 10,000 feet, which said uphill landing. So it didn't seem to be a good case of camouflage.
At this stage, were you keen to get into operational flying?
I wanted to get back there. I remember I used to see the lieutenant commander flying there, and I asked him, you know, I was supposed to be sent second line and flying for, I think they said 6 months, but and I remember him calling me into the office, or I'd been in again to see him, and he said, don't be foolish. They'll call you when they want you, and that was that. So very soon after that, I was sent to Dale in Welsh Wales to get familiarised on American aircraft. I spent time there learning to fly Hellcats, Wildcats, Corsair and Avengers.